I suppose we should begin with a summary of the topics that are on exam. I'm assuming that you would like to discuss those topics. So first of all, let me let you know that exam 2 will be carbohydrates only. No, that's because I don't have your quizzes graded still, so I don't feel comfortable asking you any more questions about that material. But I can at least ask you about the carbohydrates. So, now, of course, the final will have a few more questions about amines, because there's the mechanism, for example, for those Curtius and Hoffman rearrangements that I don't believe I asked you about yet anywhere. So they won't go away totally, but this exam will focus on carbohydrates. Let's enumerate some of the aspects of carbohydrates that you need to be responsible for. First, there's the structure of the carbohydrates themselves, which what I mean here is the different terminology that we had described the carbohydrates by. So, for example, knowing when something is a pentose versus a hexose, knowing when something is a furanose versus a pyranose, knowing when you have an aldose versus a ketose, whether something is in its alpha or beta form, of course that's only for cyclic sugars, and when something is the D versus L form of a sugar. Besides just the structures, you need to know the names of the different monosaccharides, names and structures, I should say. So that includes the aldotrioses, tetraoses, pentaoses, and hexoses. In addition to fructose, the only ketose that I had you know memorize the structure for. There is the collection of disaccharides, which we only ended up learning 3 of them out of the 4 originally I had intended. So those include maltose, lactose, and sucrose. There is a topic related to the disaccharides that we'll return to, actually 2 topics, which I'll list later on here. Began a discussion about exhaustive methylation that I didn't finish, and of course left you with that dramatic cliffhanger of what happens with the Tollens reagent. So we need to come back and see the conclusion of that. There's interconversions, 2 of them. One of them is the enolate interconversion, which, for example, explains how glucose can become both mannose and fructose in solution. And then there's mutarotation. The fact that if we start with a pure either alpha or beta enantiomer of a sugar, that it can switch into the other once you do put it into a solution. There's one topic that I guess I should go back and alert sections 1 and 2 to. There are the derivatives of sugars. Including aldetols, aldonic acids, and aldaric acids. Are 2 reactions that we covered. There's the Kiliani-Fischer chain extension. As well as this exhaustive methylation that we'll come back to. There's the Tollens test, one of the other topics that we need to finish up.
And then finally, everybody's favorite, the Fisher Stereo Chem Proof. Which inside of that, we did have a discussion of ozazones. So don't forget about ozazones.
Questions? So I think now with the inclusion of derivatives, I do have all the main topics we covered.
So let's go back and address first this exhaustive methylation.
So in order to do the exhaustive methylation, let's work with the molecule lactose, which does have galactose as one of its units. What's the other unit that's part of lactose? Glucose. So if we were to draw the sugar from left to right in the same way I did when I first showed you the structure, then we had galactose on the left, correct? Because it ended up being a substituent to glucose. Now, what was the configuration of galactose in lactose? It's in its beta form, is it not? Beta D-galactopyranosyl alpha or beta D-glucopyranose, correct? Yes? As was on that little Facebook picture that showed up a few days ago. Have you all read the chapter? Now I get to see your poker faces. Well, yes, hopefully that is the structure of galactose, because that's what section 1 and 2 and I all agreed on, so let's hope we're all correct.
So lactose has beta D glucose. No, galactopyranose unit to it. Since it's a D sugar, remember that there is an observation I made that for all D aldohexoses, the beta form, the OH group is going to be pointed up at the enantiomeric position, as well as the CH2OH group that would normally be at the bottom of the Fischer projection. Then reading sideways, I'll recall that galactose is right, left, left, right. So looking at it sideways, right, left, left, filling in my hydrogens. We then have the glucose unit that's up top here. I'll draw it in its alpha form. Recall that glucose is right, left, right, right.
Now, someone asked, wait, how do you know it's alpha-lactose? I'll come back to that answer once I've shown you the exhaustive methylation part.
So, we had started this discussion before where I said, imagine that we had methyl iodide and silver oxide react with this.
The silver oxide was a way of sneakily introducing hydroxide into solution without it being a solution of hydroxide. So the available OH groups, and we'll talk about what available means momentarily, will all get deprotonated over time and then perform SN2 with the methyl iodide, because methyl iodide can't undergo elimination, and it's a fantastic substrate for SN2 reactions. Now, what do I mean about available OH groups? Well, what do you recall about the stability of hemiacetals and ketals in basic solution? What could you say about them? Do acetals and ketals react with base? No, which is why we used them as protecting groups last quarter. You might remember the THP protecting group. So we have one acetal here, don't we?
As well as one hemiacetal. And so as far as those oxygens are concerned, the ones actually trapped in the rings. Those will not be alkylated. And it won't be alkylated because the rings, which are an acetal and a hemiacetal, are not sensitive to base.
Now, I recognize that, yeah, the connection between the rings is not itself a ring. But since it is part of this acetal, it's trapped in part of the acetal, it won't react either. Notice how I excluded the OH where my finger is currently pointed, because there's no reason that couldn't get deprotonated, because it's not trapped in a ring.
So when we exhaustively methylate, here's what we're going to get. So a whole mess of OCH3 groups. By the way, based on some conversation with the other two sections, you are allowed to bring model sets. Several of you that had comments about the Fischer stereochemistry proof or just being able to write something in a Fischer projection, which let's don't forget that we did discuss how do we deal with Fischer projections. I guess I should go back and add that to the topics here. I had so presumed it since we're so used to them now. So anyways, we've been trying to get back and forth between line structures and Fischer projections. People are having difficulties, and so I said, make a model, because that will make it so much easier to see. Now, you can make them, you can bring model sets. You cannot bring constructed your allose, altrose, glucose, mannose ahead of time and just walk in with a whole family of them as far as your model sets. You have to build them here in other ways in front of you. Let's see, model sets, what was the other thing that came up? I'll remember in just a moment. Anyways, back to this. 1, 2, 3. Yes, this is correct. Now imagine, after doing all this methylation, that we hydrolyze. We never did talk about this back in 12A, but ethers normally require strong conditions in order to cleave them. So when I show H plus in water, it really is meant to just be an acidic solution, but not of any particular acid. We would really need something like HI, hydroionic acid, in order to successively cleave an ether. So when we hydrolyte it, the acetals and ketals, or hemiacetals and hemiketals, those will fall apart. And so as far as the left-hand side of this molecule, the galactose portion, what are we going to end up with? Well, we're hydrolyzing, then we're going to lose the anomeric OH group when it converts back to a carbonyl. And that would correspond to where my pen currently is, where the two oxygens connect together. And I'm sorry, I'm pointing at the
the pre-alkylated structure. We really should be looking at the one on the right. Just notice that the next three positions have OCH3 groups
instead of OH groups. But notice what I just wrote as the final structure. The bottom stereocenter, that has an OH group on it. Why? Because it was trapped in the ring, that oxygen, at the time that the alkylation had occurred, the methylation. Again, since the ring was not centered to the base, it didn't get popped open, didn't get alkylated. Once you did finally break open the ring, though, because we switched to acidic conditions, remember that hemiacetals, hemiketals, acetals, and ketals all open and close in acidic conditions. Well, now we release that oxygen that didn't have the methyl group, which means we can figure out how big the ring was. Because the OH group that was part of the ring is the one that survives this methylation. And so find where the OH group is, you find what the size of the ring was. So from this, we know that the galactose portion of lactose was in its pyranose form, its six-membered ring form. So since the indicated oxygen was part of the ring during methylation, it did not get methylated. Since the ring was resistant to base conditions. Once the sugar was hydrolyzed, and let me specify, once the methylated sugar is hydrolyzed, the fact that one oxygen on the galactose fragment was not methylated can be used to establish that galactose was in its pyranose form when part of lactose. Now, if we did a more careful hydrolysis, there is possible to separate the two rings without necessarily being fully hydrated into their linear forms. But since I am finishing up this topic rather late, I'm just going to focus on this easier to look at left-hand side portion of the molecule, because the galactose portion of lactose only has one oxygen that's going to end up non-alkylated. For the right-hand portion of it, the glucose portion of the molecule, it has an oxygen that's tied up in the glycoside, as well as an oxygen that is part of the ring. So since there would be two places you would not have alkylation, well, we might return to that after the exam, but that portion won't be on the exam. I would just ask about something like this exact situation here. The substituent in a disaccharide, how can we figure out what its ring size is? So any questions on this topic? Then the other thing I need to wrap up as far as carbohydrates are concerned is this Tollens test. So to get at the point of the Tollens test, let me one last time try to quickly write the structure of lactose down. Yeah. Not enough. Now, for a comparison, let's write sucrose up. Which, what are the configurations in sucrose? What are the sugars in sucrose? Glucose and fructose. And glucose is in what form? It's the alpha D form, isn't it? And then what about fructose? Turns out it's the beta D form. Now, a question has come up about writing disaccharides. Ah, that was the other issue. So when I did the disaccharides, I first wrote them in, for most of them, in such a way where the anomer position was on the right-hand side of the molecule as is standard for Haworth projections. But as we saw for not lactose, but maltose, that in order to avoid having a curved-looking bond, I rewrote the molecule by flipping or turning one or the two sugar units around. Sucrose, you end up having to do the exact same thing. But it's not necessary for you to represent a disaccharide in any particular way for the exam, because I don't remember seeing a rule in your textbook that they must be drawn a certain way. And so as I draw sucrose up, I'm just going to focus on, can I write the two sugar units correctly? And then I'll hook them together by whatever bond I want to. And I'm not going to rewrite it as I've done in past examples. Now, if you choose to rewrite it, that's fine. If that horribly confuses you, you want to do what I'm about to do, that would be fine. It'll just be on the burden of me to make sure that I'm looking at all these structures correctly. But over the years, I've gotten pretty good at reading these, so I'm not worried about that. It's, can you draw it correctly somehow? So, if we have alpha-D-glucopyranosyl as one of our units, here's alpha-D-glucopyranosyl, beta-D, fructofuranose. So D sugar means CH2OH group is up. Beta means the OH group is up. Remember that for fructose, both carbons on either side of that oxygen have CH2OH groups on them. Then the bottom three stereocenters in fructose are the same as... arabidose. Yes, and glucose and mannose. So it would be left, right, right. So left, right. Well, and the last one we turn around anyways. And oops.
I have one too many opposite ones.
Because I'm now going to connect the two sugars together.
And someone from the other sections had the same response I did, which is, well, that's kind of unsatisfying, this big snake-like bond. But this is done on purpose this time, again, because I'm focusing on being able to draw the two sugar units, not focusing on how to make the overall picture prettier. Now, moving along to what's the point of this, why am I showing you these molecules again?
Because if we react them both with the Tollens reagent, diamine silver, we get contrasting results. For the lactose, we end up with a mirror, a silver mirror. For the sucrose, we don't end up with that. What's the significance? Well, in terms of the terminology we're learning, we would say lactose is a reducing sugar. Which, remember that what reduces gets oxidized. So the sugar is providing electrons to silver to cause silver to fall out of solution and make the mirror. That means, in turn, lactose is the thing losing those electrons, and it gets oxidized.
But for the sucrose, there is no mirror, which means sucrose is not getting oxidized. And we would say sucrose is not a reducing sugar.
Now, what's going on here? Well, two things. Recall that ketones normally shouldn't react with the Tollens test anyways. I say shouldn't in quotes, because there's one notable exception, which is when we have alpha hydroxy ketones. You remember earlier that in the list of topics I reviewed, one of those topics is the fact that we can have tautomerization occur in solution. So even if we had a ketose, ketoses are automatically alpha hydroxy ketones, which means they could isomerize in solution into an aldehyde and then get oxidized. Aside from that, under the conditions of the Tollens reagent, these hemiacetal and ketal rings can open and get oxidized. But a pure acetal or ketal cannot. The better way of putting it is that in solution, in these conditions of the Tollens test, the cyclic and linear forms of aldoses and ketoses are in equilibrium with each other. But we are going to find out that because sucrose is a double, well, it's not double acetal. One half's an acetal, one half's a ketal. But neither of them are hemiacetals or hemiketals. They don't exist, either of those two sugar units, in equilibrium with their linear forms. So they never get oxidized, which is why sucrose is not a reducing sugar.
So under the conditions of the Tollens test,
hemiacetals and hemiketals are able to exist in equilibrium with their linear aldehyde or ketone forms. Which, if they're in an aldehyde form, or in this case, because of the alpha hydroxy ketone form, that means they can be oxidized. Ketals and acetals, full ketals and acetals, do not exist in equilibrium with their linear forms. So they do not get oxidized. Now let's look at the sugars. And we can see that lactose has an acetal and a hemiacetal. While as sucrose has an acetal, and remember that there's an oxygen here. This is a ketal. So there's no hemiacetal or hemiketal in sucrose. There is in lactose. So since lactose has a hemiacetal, it reacts with the Tollens reagent. But since sucrose only has a full acetal and ketal, it does not react.
And that's all we needed to cover with the Tollens reagent. So are there any questions? What's that? You mean what is a ketone?
It's a ketone because
there's two oxygens connected to one carbon. On that same carbon, there's a carbon, not a hydrogen attached. And so that makes it a ketone. Any other questions?
And we have a little time left. But let me specify that what we're going to talk about next
may unfortunately be ignored for a few days, because rightfully so, you're going to focus on your exams. But as soon as we're done with that,
we get the joy of starting amino acids, which I've drawn an example of one.
You can see there's an amino group on it. There's an acid group on it. Well, that means we have both basic and acidic functionality on the same molecule,
which gives them some unusual behavior. And let's talk about the different forms of amino acid that might exist depending on the pH of solution. So for example, we had
really, really acidic conditions.
Unless we had supremely acidic conditions, it is unlikely that we would protonate the carboxylic acid portion of this molecule. But an amine is a base, it easily gets protonated. So under acid conditions, we're most likely to find an amino acid in this way. It's protonated or cationic form.
Now, as we decrease the acidity level, increase pH, eventually we're going to have deprotonation occur. And it turns out that the pKa for the acid is much lower than for the protonated amine.
Which means as you get more and more basic and we lose a hydrogen, it doesn't come off the NH3+, comes off the carboxylic acid. Another way of expressing this is that
this is an amino acid, which means you've got acid and base functionality. Well, once it's in solution, what's to prevent it from neutralizing itself? Well, nothing. So this has the same number of atoms as the neutral structure I wrote above.
And this would be what would exist under neutral conditions. It's just you have this built-in positive and negative charge, which is why this is called a Zwitter ion, or literally twin ion.
But since it's a plus and a minus, that means it is overall neutral.
Now, continue to reduce the acidity level, and eventually you're going to coax the ammonium salt to become deprotonated as well. So that happens under basic conditions. And that means we now have the anionic form of the amino acid.
So what? The more acidic it gets, the more protonated it gets, the more basic it gets, the more deprotonated it gets. And what we'll talk about after the exam is we can quantify all this with pKa values. Well, think about what the functionality of those functional groups are. If I throw an acid at something already protonated and already with an octet rule, is it going to want to get protonated? No. So, of course, it has to protonate with the carboxylic acid. The reverse direction. This is a carboxylic acid, so a base is going to react with the acid portion first. You're saying the right thing, but you're kind of saying something that's kind of the definition of acid-base chemistry. Acids react with bases. But you're correct that the only certain protonations or deprotonations are going to occur, but it's just based on what's an acid and what's a base. Now, avoiding any of the quantitative discussion, though, let's at least talk about what distribution of these three forms would we expect to see in solution. Because, you know, our body has a certain pH. blood pH, for example, is right about 7.2, isn't it? 7.2, 7.25. Deviation of much more than 0.2 pH units, I remember, is fatal. Which that means just this much change in pH. So there's an awful lot of sensitivity in these acid-base equilibria.
And so let's find a way to discuss what would the proportion of these things look like in solution. Now, I don't remember if there was a nice, elegant name for this kind of graph, but it's going to be a graph of two things. In this case, we're going to make the x-axis pH,
which recognize that we're doing a titration curve, which we will. Normally, pH would be the x-axis. But this is not a titration. This is us trying to figure out what's the proportion of these different forms of the amino acid as a result of the pH. So pH is therefore our x-axis, and it's going to be mole fraction that ends up being our y-axis. So mole fraction has a maximum of 1, and I'm hoping that somebody in here remembers their Chem 1A well enough to say what a mole fraction is. What is a mole fraction? And unlike section 1, don't tell me half a mole. Ratio of what? What those exactly? Close. It is the number of moles of one species versus the total moles of all things in solution. So it's not just the ratio between the two of them, but it's like a percentage, if you wanted to say. Now, since we could start with just the cationic version, for example, and since these interconversions are just 1 and 1 and 1, the total number of moles is never going to change. So that's why I'm saying we could treat this a little bit like percentage.
Now, we will have three things in solution. The acidic form, the neutral form, and then the basic form. And it might make sense that if we are in extremely acidic conditions, like pH 0, that 99.99999% of that molecule is going to be in its protonated acidic form. So we expect to have a mole fraction of 1 for that acid form. Similar logic, if we're in really, really, really basic conditions, we would expect to have 100% of the base form. What might make sense, but you might have to reason a bit to demonstrate for your own self that it would make sense, is that somewhere between the two, we're going to maximize the neutral form of this molecule. Now notice I've left off any specific pH values, because once we do start talk about the different kinds of amino acids, each of them have their own structure, there's extra groups that can influence the acidity of the amino or the acid portions of that molecule. So that's why I've left the numbers out on purpose, so this is a generalized discussion. And let's continue that discussion just a bit, because I know we're about out of time. But starting out with extremely acidic solution, we only have the acid form, but as we add base to the solution,
eventually that amino acid's going to start getting deprotonated. And eventually you add enough base, one equivalent worth, where the whole deprotonation, that first deprotonation, is complete. So in terms of how much of the acid form around, it might look something like this.
At the same time that that acid form is decreasing, the neutral form is increasing.
Of course, once you've added one equivalent of base and removed one of the two protons available,
well, you're going to start deprotonating the second one. Which, deprotonating that second one means you're making the basic version, which means you're destroying the neutral version. And so this is what the curve looks like. Now, where we're going to go with this discussion is to talk about the significance of these two points that I just marked, where the curves cross. Because if this was a titration, that point would be the half equivalence point. And as some of you shudder to remember, in 1B we discussed how there's something special that happens at that half equivalence point, which we'll discuss first. What's the idealization that you have to make for that simplification to occur? But then once it occurs, how does that lead us to this thing called the Henderson-Hasselbalch equation? Which both the derivation and this graph are testable material on exam 3, which is why I warned you 6 weeks ago to freshen up on your acid-base chemistry. But we're out of time, so along with some studying for OChem, I hope that you have a nice long weekend.